but apparently is whether or not it was a mistake or it wasn't a mistake. And I will, in the book, I explain why I think it was. And
what you think it was.
You think. And what I think is also the same as what Ken officially investigated.
You weren't there when the ship was being napalmed, torpedoed, when we got to close hatches on guys that were in a hole dying. Well, you weren't there for that, but you think. So you write a book on what you think.
No, well,
here's a man. Here's a man that wrote a book.
Well, let's let him hear. No, but he's got to speak. He's got to speak. No, wait.
No.
I shut.
He's going to talk to you at great length. But right now, we're going to talk about a book that I wrote.
Yes.
And you wrote it. I think it's full of trash. And you don't have to read it.
I wouldn't.
If you don't read it, then you won't know whether it's full of trash or whether you get it.
I'm going to give you money.
I didn't ask you to give me any money.
$29
for your book.
I wouldn't read it.
And I appreciate yours, and I'm sorry you don't feel that I'm
entitled to it. No, it's not that I don't feel that you're entitled to yours. Yeah, so don't protect them.
I don't think you're entitled. You're
friends.
We're both in the United States.
Okay, well.
You got accepted to the wrong branch then, buddy.
Buddy.
A lot of times when people take the bench,
they sort of disappear from life as far as working in the community and doing some things. I remember clearly a couple years ago when we were doing Op Sale 2000 in Miami, and we needed someone to run the aviation part of Op Sale. And Jay Crystal said, "Oh, I'm busy down bankruptcy court, but you can count on me." And if you went down to the port and saw the wonderful display of all those antique planes and the wonderful planes that went over, it was just Crystal that did that in between deciding cases, writing books, and taking care of his obligations. So it has been a great deal of honor. Now, Judge, I want you to know that we expect this book to win many great acclaim, much great acclaim, many great honors over the years. But for the fact that you've chosen to introduce your book in Coral Gables, even though you went to B-Tie, we have for you this great seal of the city of Coral Gables for your writing desk, so that as you look for and you write your second book, you can look and be inspired, and we wish you all the best. It's my honor and privilege to present to your man, Judge Jay Crystal, the author of that. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Welcome to all of you. I'm so delighted to see so many friends and familiar faces here tonight. And I'm going to spend a few minutes telling you about the book. But I'm not going to tell you what's in the book. I'm going to let you read it for that. And I'm going to give you some background information. Basically, what you should know was that on the 8th day of June, 1967, a terrible tragedy occurred off the coast of the Sinai. A United States Navy ship, the USS Liberty, which had been dispatched there under orders which were canceled, but unfortunately the canceled orders never reached the ship, arrived in the middle of the Six-Day War. It was a hot war, it was a dangerous situation, and through a series of blunders, both on the part of the United States and on the part of the State of Israel, the ship was attacked, 34 gallant U.S. sailors lost their lives, 171 were wounded, and many of the survivors, even today, 35 years later, suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome. We have with us tonight a man who was on that ship, a man named Smith in the back of the room. Mr. Smith is there. He went through hell. He should have our respect and our honor. He did nothing wrong. He was in a place that was most unfortunate. He strongly disagrees with the conclusions in my book, which in this free country he has every right to do. And all I say to you is that if you read the book, I tell you I'm not out to convince anyone of anything. I'm only out to present a substantial collection of facts. Those facts were collected over 15 years. I started out at the University of Miami and thought I was talking to doing some research on this subject, for which I thought would take a year. That evolved into a 10-year project, and during which time I completed a PhD at the Graduate School of International Studies. The PhD is on file in the Library of Congress. And I did my own independent research. I interviewed over 500 people, both on the Israeli side and on the U.S. side. I talked to people such as Secretary of State Lew Rusk, Secretary of Defense McNamara, Admiral Kidd, Admiral Martin, Admiral McDonnell, many people that were involved on the U.S. side. During the course of events, I became acquainted with him and became a friend of the captain of Liberty, William McGonigal, who tragically died of cancer just a few years ago. I had been trying to work with Captain McGonigal to take him and perhaps one of his crew members to Israel to meet some of the people that were involved there, but the entire time and illness prevented that from coming to fruition. I know a number of Liberty crew members. Many of them have been through a trauma that they cannot forget. It's not easy when someone has shot at you, perhaps wounded you and killed your buddies, to accept the concept that maybe it was all a mistake. The general response to friendly fire casualty. So I don't want to convince you, Mr. Smith, or any other of the crew members who gets any comfort or feeling of well-being from the idea that he believes that it was not a mistake. But there have been 3 Israeli official investigations, 7 U.S. presidents, from Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter, Nixon, Reagan, Reagan, Ford,
Bush,
Ford, Reagan, thank you, Ford, Reagan, Bush, and Clinton have all concurred in the opinion that this was a tragic mistake. And the book lays out not only the official investigation, but we also examined a substantial number of conspiracy theories that have been told, and it discusses them in detail. Many conflict with each other. For example, this one story, somebody was there fighting with the Arabs against Israel. There's another story that Liberty was there fighting with Israel against the Arabs. Seems to me that both of those stories can't be true, in fact, neither of them were true. There are a lot of other stories, some with a certain amount of reason to them, others are bizarre. I suggest if you are not completely satisfied with what's in the book, because the editors insist on cutting it down and not publishing everything, that you go to my website, thelibertyincident.com, where I have posted numerous things, such as, for example, the actual official Central Intelligence Agency report, a portion of the National Security Agency report, the actual President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board report, and I'll be putting more official investigations on there in the future, but you can see the original documents being looked at by people at the time, and find out for yourself. It's an interesting story. It's a sad story, but it's taught us a number of lessons, which I've tried to discuss in the book. Rather than tell you about what's in the book, let me tell you a little bit about the research. When I first started the research, I traveled to Israel. I had, through my naval connections, met years before some Israeli naval officers who by then had become rather high ranking. And when I called and said, "I'm coming over to do some research on this project," I went for assistance. They said, "No problem." Immediately upon arrival in Israel, I was allowed to board a Dabur. Dabur is Hebrew for wasp. And it is an anti-terrorist patrol boat. And I went on the wall over here, and I spent 26 hours on anti-terrorist patrol, during the course of which we bailed out to the point off of El Arish, where the attack actually took place. Later on, I got to go out there by boat a second time. Still during the research, on 2 other occasions, I flew out there by air. So I've probably been out to that point for more than most people that are connected with the issue. Although there's not a lot to see out there, I always feel that when you're doing an investigation, it's worthwhile to go to the scene to see what you can see there. When I was out there that night, we stopped. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. It was pitch black, except on the horizon there was a glow of light from El Arish. And on the boat was the captain. He was a reserve officer who was doing his weekend duty on an anti-terrorist patrol. And when this event occurred, he was 10 years old. There was a regular Navy petty officer who ran the engines on the boat. He was 13 when the event occurred. And the other 7 Israeli sailors had not yet been born. In fact, they didn't know anything about the event. And we sat there under the moon on that night in the middle of it, not the middle, on the edge of the Mediterranean, and they all sat clustered around me, and I told them the story of the Liberty. And they immediately said to me when I finished, So after this happened and they discovered that it was a mistake, why didn't they take the ship? Why didn't they take the ship into Ashdod, the Israeli port, which is just north of the border there? And of course, you see, 27 years later, things had changed. Back in 1967, there hadn't been a U.S. Navy ship visiting Israel for many, many years. Today, they're going into port in Haifa almost weekly. There's a new ship in. Sometimes they have five ships in at one time. And in those days, the situation between the United States Navy and the Israel Navy was very remote, whereas today, they have joint exercises with both navies and the Turkish Navy and other operations in the area. So it was an interesting and exciting experience, one of many. And Israel, like the United States, has bureaucracies, and sometimes I wonder which bureaucracy is the most complex, trying to deal with bureaucrats to pry loose information, to get documents declassified, is very similar in both countries. As I mentioned, I had my initial good luck with the Navy because I met Israeli naval officers in 1976 when they had sent boats over here to participate in our fall ship celebration in New York Harbor and then came to Miami. But the Air Force was a different problem. It was excruciatingly difficult to get the Air Force to talk to me. Ultimately, they did. They opened up. They gave me information and made valuable contributions to the book. On the government side, I worked and worked to talk to people in the government with great difficulty. And of course, I would take short trips over there, and I start to make some progress. I meet with the people in field security. I meet with people in the spokesman's office. And as time went on, and I developed a little rapport and a little bit of a connection, and I was getting a little bit of information, I'd have to go home. And then, 6 months or a year later, I'd come back, and I'd start where I left. Who are you? We never heard of you. Well, you have no such merits, and we'd be back to ground zero. I was very interested in interviewing Yitzhak Rabin. Yitzhak Rabin was the chief of staff of the Israeli military in 1967. And at the time that I was there, he was the attention minister to the prior government. And I struggled and struggled to get to meet him. And finally, I got as close as his personal spokesman, a gentleman named Eitan Hager. And I'm sure that every one of you has seen Eitan Hager on television. And you will remember him because when they had the TV of Yitzhak Rabin's funeral, he was the gentleman that came up to the microphone and told how Yitzhak Rabin had just finished tuning his song and then had folded the paper four parts and put it in his breast pocket and pulled out that piece of paper and opened it, showing the bullet hole and the blood on it. Very dramatic part of the funeral ceremony. But in any event, this was before that, and he was Rabin's protector. I couldn't get to him without getting through Hay there. And so finally I had him on the telephone one day, and I said, look, give me 6 minutes. And if I can't convince you in 6 minutes that I should talk to the minister, I'll stop following you. So he said, okay, so I went over, and I rushed over to the Ministry of Defense. Located in Syria. I don't know how many of you have been to Tel Aviv, but if you go down Dizengoff Street, it takes a left turn and becomes Capitol Street, and there is the Israel Syria, which is the equivalent of our Pentagon, their entire defense establishment working here. And I went into the Ministry of Defense, so I sat down next to the deputy in front of a guy who happens to be a well-respected journalist who has written many books, and I took out my stopwatch and clicked it, and I said, now look, you as a journalist should know, I mean, I believe I know from reading publication, other material, exactly what Mr. Levine would say, but in order to complete my research, I need to see him eyeball to eyeball and put the question to him so that I can say, this is what I asked him, and this is what he told me, not that this is what I heard someone say he said. And I was actually only about 5 minutes into my pitch when he said, you're right, you should see him. So, he started looking at the 11th book and he was busy, I stay there. So I went home and after exchange of telephone calls and faxes, I finally came back to Israel with a firm appointment to meet with him. And I went to the Ministry of Defense, and by this time I had been traveling to Israel a number of times, and so I had become accustomed to their ways. In fact, you see, I was wearing clothing tie. I was wearing jeans and a white shirt. And I think the Ministry of Defense for my 5 o'clock appointment, and I was worried because I heard in the newspaper, or I mean, I heard on the radio and read in the newspaper, that Levine was meeting to the United States at 7 o'clock that night. And my brother was at 5. I wasn't sure I was actually going to get to see him. And I was waiting in the hallway when the door to his office opened, and out came the United States Ambassador, Ambassador Brown, wearing a blue blazer, gray flannel trousers, a white shirt, and a striped tie, followed by an assistant dressed exactly the same way. And they walked, they shook hands and walked away, and I was ushered in, and Levine was there in a suit and a shirt and a tie. And I sat down on the outside of the desk, and he sat on the other side of the desk, and we looked at each other for a moment, and he said, do you mind if I take off my tie? And there you see a picture of the two of us standing behind Levine's desk, me in my jeans and white shirt, and the defense minister with his collar open, who had taken off his tie. And Levine, if you don't know, was the type of person he was, what we call a clean desk person. He never left a piece of paper on his desk. Whenever he finished, everything came off his desk. The only thing that remained on his desk was the eternal flame. What is that, you wonder? You can see his little silver cup-like thing on the desk. Levine was a chain smoker. And when he finished one cigarette, he would take another one and stick it in that little flame and light the next one. He was never without a cigarette or whatever. It's all possible. We introduced ourselves, and I can see he was kind of weird. He had a long day and was getting ready to make it. 11 hour flight across the Atlantic. And of course I've been preparing for this interview for months. I had hundreds of questions that I could have asked him. But somehow I didn't think that was going to do me a lot of good. And so I said to him, Mr. Minister, I know you're very busy. You're in one day. You're going to be on the stage in a few minutes. And I would like to ask you 2 questions, and I'll be out of your hair in 12 minutes. And what kind of attention? The kind of looked up, he was bright enough to look up. And I said, what are your 2 questions? And I said, the first question is, did you give any orders relating to the liberty, or know of any orders relating to the liberty of the liberty? Before the commandments completely open. He said, no, of course not. I know that the Catholic orders, I knew the Catholic orders, so I learned them after. And he said, what's your answer to the question? And I said, well, is there anything that you think might be of value to me in my research of this matter? And he kind of sat down and telling me the entire history of the 1967 war. It was fascinating. On and on he went. I was there scribbling my notes, and finally I do have a lead, and after about 30 minutes I said, thank you, just to be sure and try to get up. And not at all, probably more. And another time I saw you arrive, again, I didn't sit down. I had about 48 minutes with him. With him was a military aide, General David Schobauer, general, who was in with us in 15 minutes. And as we were about to conclude, I thanked him and I said, the only thing I can say to you is it's been a very interesting experience for me, and I'm looking forward to continuing my doctoral dissertation and continuing the research. But since Israel is so similar to the United States, dragging information out of the government and out of the military, I don't know whether I will live long enough to finish this project. And he said, he looked at me and he said, "Well, since you know I'm leaving right now in just a few minutes, you know, there's nothing more that I can do for you." But he said, "My friend David here, General Chaval, perhaps he can be of some assistance to you." So Rabin got up and left to the airport and left his office and went down the hall to David Chaval's office. And we sat there for an hour and a half and went over a large number of things that I was trying to accomplish and documents I was trying to obtain. And in particular, I had located the chief of Israel Navy Intelligence, who was then living in Haifa. And I had contacted him and made an appointment to meet with him. And on my previous trip, I had been told, yes, it's okay to go see the chief of intelligence. And so I had been told him to call the security office and confirm that it's all right for you to talk to me. And so I called from Tel Aviv, and I said, "Everything okay?" He said, "Everything's okay, except that I called the office and they never heard of you. I don't know what you're talking about. I have no authority to speak." And so I said, "Well, I'm coming to high school anyhow, and so let's meet as scheduled. And if you can't talk, we'll have a cup of coffee and say goodbye. Otherwise, see what we can do." So I had told this problem to General Chaval. When I got to Haifa 2 days later, I met the intelligence chief as planned, and I said, "Were you able to call the Ministry of Defense about permission to talk to me?" He said, "They called me. They told me to meet with you and answer any questions or anything that I know." And so that was another door that opened, and was very, very helpful. There were many, many doors that opened, that some seemed pure luck. I will confess to a great deal of assistance in many matters. For example, in the airport, when I first got put in touch with a lower-ranking Air Force officer, and they sent me around, you know, and I left the country, I came back the next time, and sent me around again, and the third time I came back, I still didn't make much progress, but on the fourth trip back, he told me, "You know, the first time you came here, we thought you were just another loud-mouthed person. The second time he came back, we were kind of surprised. When he came back the third time, we were really surprised. And now that you're the fourth time, we decided it's time you can meet the chief of the airport." So I went to Air Force headquarters, met the chief of the Air Force, and through him I was introduced to a number of people that were involved, and ultimately I was able to meet eyeball to eyeball the three living pilots who attacked the Liberty. There were four, one died in the crash, as I mentioned before. Do not want their names to explode. As far as I know, they have only talked to the Senate Select Committee for Intelligence, which went there to interview them, and they were provided to the staff members behind the screen, so they were never seen. I sat with them, I've gone back and talked to them again, and again I've had lunch with them, they're friends, and they're very interesting people, and The simple fact of the matter is that although there have been 10 official U.S. investigations, and there has been very little research conducted in Israel in respect, only the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence went to Israel, officially to the government. The other investigations were done both in the United States, was done by the 10 television production companies. They first came here, met with a number of local crew members from Washington, filmed them, their point of view, and their thoughts, then went to Israel, and when they got there, they were expecting what has been the norm. For more than 10 years, the United States had kept the United States Court of Inquiry report classified. Israel kept all that stuff classified. And so the general Israeli response was no comment. And the 10 people went to Israel expecting to take a few background shots and report that these were the claims that were made and the allegations that were made, and Israel said no comment. Luckily for Israel, three people who were in the IDF spokesman's office didn't buy that. One was Colonel Renan Gittin, who's seen him on television frequently. He's presently the spokesman for the present prime minister. Another was a fellow named Matty Greenberg, who was in the IDF history branch, the army colonel. And then the final one was a lieutenant colonel. Actually, then he was a major, James Grossman. And the three of them went to the wall with the spokesman and argued and said, it's not serving anyone's best interest to, we ought to open up and tell whatever needs to be told to them at the air here in the track. And they prevailed. The Senate television program was clearly, they were suddenly shocked at the sudden profusion of information they were getting. They did quite a bit of shooting in Israel, taped a number of Navy and Air Force officers, and produced a program which, I guess the worst you can say about it was that it was balanced, or the best you can say about it was that it was balanced. It didn't accept one side or the other. It merely listed the claims, the conspiracy claims, that it was a malicious, treacherous attack, and the Israeli explanation of the attack, and left the decision up to the audience as to whether they just believe it was an attack on knowing that it was U.S. ship or whether it was a mistake and an attack on the U.S. ship. And so there have been a number of television programs. There have been several since. One came out on the History Channel, which was a rather poorly done program for a number of reasons. And here we are today, 35 years later. There have been numerous other disasters involving our military where people were killed, friendly fire or otherwise injured, and they all seem to be forgotten, except for this Liberty incident, which remains a hot-button issue. It has people still in a very passionate, emotional position. Letters are written, editors, op-ed pieces are written, articles are written, and it doesn't seem to want to go away, and it may never go away. My book was not written to take a point of view. I started out, actually starting out looking for smoking guns to see if I could confirm some of these claims of a treacherous or an intentional attack. And I must say that had I found the evidence, I would certainly have put it in a book. But I discussed the matter with Admiral Isaac Kidd, the president of the United States Naval Department, to whom I dedicated the book. And I asked my kid, I said, did you find the smoking gun? And he said, I mean, final word. There is a court of inquiry record that is hundreds of pages long, many, many documents, many, many pictures, and I would suggest that people read this report and make their own decision as to whether or not it was a full and complete investigation that came to reasonable and responsible conclusions. Following that, the CIA issued a report, and as I said, you can see that in its entirety on my website. I'll have the short history on there eventually. And the various other reports, they're all there, and that's what the book is about. It's been a fantastic experience for me. I actually interviewed everyone in Israel who was involved in the Liberty Incident, from the chief of staff, it's not for being that's behind this gentleman, is a chart which will show you the chief of staff all the way down to the people who pulled the triggers on the murder torpedo boats and the people who pulled the triggers in the aircraft. And over 500 interviews, I selected about 3,000 and some documents, which I'm going to, now that the book is complete, send at the request of the Hoover Institute at Stanford University to them. They want to be a part of the permanent collection there, so the researchers will insist and go and take a look at it. And that's what it's all about. I think that it's warm in here, and maybe we can throw open the floor for a few questions.
My name is Stephen Strobe, I'm a retired naval officer. I have not read the book. I have no direct knowledge of the Liberty Incident. I have spoken to several survivors. I spoke to, shortly after the incident, I spoke to the dance control party officers there later on. I see the Herald reporting that the plane was attacked by a jet. I'm glad you clarified that there were four. Also, I do have a question about it. This was a prolonged attack, as you know from your research.
No, sir, it was not a prolonged attack.
Okay, well, let me ask a question.
Yes, it was.
A supporter of Israel, a fan of Israel from my boyhood, and a 31-year naval officer, Navy career, a veteran of three wars, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. Would you concede that the governments of the United States and the governments of Israel, or the governments of the United States and Israel, have strong reasons to, in effect, bury this as friendly fire or mistaken identity, when anything else would bring down an uproar from the American population?
The official record clearly establishes that the air attack lasted between 12 and 14 minutes. After it was terminated, there is a time of about 25 minutes went by when the motor torpedo boats arrived and began flashing the signal lights, saying, "Who are you? Identify yourself." It is undisputed, if you read the record of the captain, the court of inquiry, who testified that at that point, Liberty opened fire on the motor torpedo boats, and they want the torpedoes another 10 to 20 minutes to attack. You read many places the attack lasted 3 hours, the attack lasted 5 hours, 9 hours. The record established when it happened. Now, when you say the government had reason not to tell the truth, actually, almost everything has been disclosed or released. There has been what Bill Goulding, who was the deputy defense minister for public affairs, called a cover-up. What Simon Vance, who was the number two man in defense, said was not a cover-up. But what that had to do with was the false statement made by the United States about why the Liberty was there. That's what has been kept classified and lied about for a number of reasons, which I discussed in detail in the book. They had to do with politics, they had to do with security, but as to the issues of what happened, as to the attack and the tragedy that ensued as a result of the attack, I don't believe that was covered up. And more recently, in 1987, Penn Television obtained the release of the Israel Air Force audio tape of the attack. Those tapes are translated and transcribed and translated and are an appendix to my book. And if you read the conversations that went back and forth, I think that you would probably agree that there was nothing but confusion and a mistake as to what took place there. What they did afterwards in the, whether you want to call it a cover-up or not, that's a matter of you can make your own judgment on it. I say the respectable people have called it those things. But the security, the cover-up, or the holding back had nothing to do with whether or not it was a mistake. It had to do with the false statements that the Liberty was sent there for a reason, which is spelled out in the book, and which I'm sure you'll find it all there. At least I hope you will.
Judge, we both have something in common. We have the same color mustache. That's it. But I have to say something. I want to tell you who I am. I'm a nobody. And I haven't met... Wait a minute. I have to say I'm a nobody. I haven't met Rabin. But I'll tell you who I am. I'm the one who answered your little letter in the Herald with the flawed argument. And I am a comedic... My name is Richard Block.
In that letter in the Miami Herald,
that's right.
You said you were a security officer.
Excuse me. Could I give me a chance to talk? Okay. I was during the Six-Day War a signal intelligence officer. Okay. I worked 16-hour shifts during the whole war. Okay. I was working for an Air Force unit in the Rapid Air Station Crete. Okay. We were monitoring EC-121 flights, C-130 flights, the Liberty, the fleet, and the Israelis and the Arabs, okay? And I'll tell you what. You know, you may have done, and I'm not trying to put you down, all your research, you've met Rabin, you've met everybody else, okay? But the story is here is that I got the milk and ears. What the truth is, okay?
So,
it has nothing to do with because we had Hebrew language, okay? I'm not going to go into details, okay? All I'm going to tell you is, anyone that's here, check me up with DOD, find out where I was at what time. And I have to tell you, I don't want to get, you know, like shot down. I don't know any of these people in Liberty. I just saw his thing. I don't know anything about this movement. And frankly, your little letter spurred me to tell what the truth is, okay? I was there during the whole six-day war. There are things that I know that you'll never know. Because you say you got recordings from pilots? Hey, they change recordings. They what do you call it? You know, two of my critics got down to the basement of the White House and into Johnson's hands during that war, okay? And what you say, fine, you have your right to say it, but I saw what the truth is, okay? And I'm here to testify that these men, okay, were definitely attacked deliberately by the Israeli Air Force, okay? And there's no way you can cut the mustard because your research can go on for ages and ages and ages and ages. But once that critic left my hands, okay, and got circulated throughout all the intelligence agencies, that critic was squashed. They put a seal on it, hermetically sealed everything. And what happened to these people is unforgivable. Unforgivable. The Israeli government has, yeah. Oh, yeah, now, okay, fine. Fine.
Sure, what happened was a terrible tragedy. And we all are grateful to them for the sacrifice they made serving their country. I would point out to you that if you were in Crete, you couldn't have heard any UHF transmissions. In your letter in the Herald, it quoted you as sending critical messages. You meant
no, critic, sure.
There is no record of any critic messages.
Well, obviously, it's not.
But I would say to you,
please, sir.
He has audio tapes. And
please, sir.
Martin Nowicki, who was aboard the EC-121, who heard them, and two other Hebrew language persons, have all reported that what the tapes show,
sir.
There are tapes, not the Israeli tapes,
sir.
The tapes show that the tapes are tragedy. Now,
all I have to say is check out whether I was there or not and who I was, okay? I don't have to defend myself with pictures of prime ministers or things. I'm defending myself who I am, okay? That's it. Who I am. I was there. You weren't there, sir, okay?
Okay, now, can I tell you something? I was really there. All right? I want to tell you the attack lasted for 2 hours or more. All right? Now, you said yourself, you went out to the spot. All right? You look back on the beach, you seen the dim lit light, right? What did the Israelis say? That we were bombarding them. Did they not?
Well, if you read the book, you'll find that out.
Oh, I don't need the book. I'm telling you. Did they tell... I don't need the book. I'm trying to ask you a question. Did they or did they not say that we were bombarding their shore?
If you read the book, you'll see...
Well, look at...
Oh, you're as bad as they are. You want to cover everything
up. No, the point of it is...
Can you answer my question?
No, the point... Wait a minute. The point of it... The whole point of it is we have an obvious two points of view. We have two points of view. Somebody that's done research and people that have been there. We have been there. We have been there. We were there.
Don't say another word.
Fine.
You can ask the question. I would ask you to ask the question or make a short statement.
I asked the question.
Wait 1 second. Please don't go beyond that. What I'd like to do is afterwards, during the order, we can have a more civil discussion as well that won't escalate into something
that the people won't hear.
So let's try to
That's what the problem is.
It's a very, very volatile issue.
Sure
it
is.
And I think what I would be happy to do is talk to both of you and explain to you about some of the processes in which maybe you can get a book written as well to explain your side.
I got the real book right here.
More than happy to present you.
I got the real book, right?
Just let George Crystal answer the question.
Will he answer my question?
He will, and please don't interrupt him.
Okay, let's go.
The question is not that simple, but yes, there was a perception that they were being bombarded by the sea, and it's reported...
How far does a 50 caliber machine gun fire?
That's not the point.
The point is, it cannot reach land, can it?
No, you're absolutely right, but you also can't see a 50 caliber machine.
How fast does the Ludwig travel? 18 knots. How fast does a torpedo boat go?
I invited you to lunch, and I will be happy to...
I'm asking you a question about your book.
...for hours, but it's all in the book. And as I started to say,
I'll buy you.
Keep proud to
buy you.
I'll buy
you. Lady, you cut that off. Your shipmate told the story in writing 35 years ago.
You got emotional issues. Admiral Kidd even came forward and said it was a cover-up. That's all right. Relax. That's all right.
She was an Abidjan Ivory Coast when the crisis developed. She was ordered to Rhodes of Spain, where she picked up Arabic linguists. She then sailed toward the war, toward the sea, to listen to what was going on in the Sinai, and that is why she was actually sent there. But she was overcome by events. The war started, and suddenly they realized they had stayed in the form of the United Nations. They had been shipped within hundreds of miles, and yet here was a ship about to enter that zone. And so they began sending messages. The Congressional Investigation of 1971, House Armed Services Committee, very detailed document. Spells out how five messages were misrouted. I wish I had time to tell you about it, but you can read it in the book. And they went to the wrong place. They didn't get to Liberty until after she said that. If any one of them had been seen, she would have pulled back and it never would have happened.
It says Israel requested the U.S. Liberty to leave, but it never left. Is that a true statement? Did they ever receive that message, and would they have left if they'd received that statement?
Well, that story is told by Anthony Pearson in his book, Conspiracy of Silence, and by a number of other people. However, there is no record of any such messages. Those stories generally deal with the claim that Liberty was there for several days before the attack occurred. As a matter of fact, Liberty arrived on station at 8:49 that morning and began sailing down the coast.
as you always later in the attack.
Yes, sir. Judge, as you know, the Russian newspaper Pravda has recently published a number of articles and interviews about the Liberty Attack. And you and I discussed it. I was wondering if you had an opinion as to why Pravda is so interesting.
Well, Pravda, in 1967, published an article by Yuri Primakov, who was then the editor for Pravda, in which he claimed that the Liberty was there fighting for Israel against the Arabs, and that the attack was done jointly by the CIA and Israel to cover up this dastardly cooperation. He went on to write a book called The Dove is in the East, which is translated, and goes on with that story. And in my research in the Arab world, many Arabs, most Arabs, like to accept that story because emotionally it was far more acceptable to believe that they were defeated in 1967 by the United States than by Middle Israel. But the simple fact of the matter is Russia was pushing for influence in the area. The recent articles which you were kind enough to send me, two of them are by former Liberty crew members, Mr. Panowski and Mr. Phil Cardi, the president of the Liberty Veterans Association. And those articles are their beliefs, but I suggest that if anyone wants to do serious research, read the documents, read the stories, and then make your own decision. Yes?
We have spread your book, and you clearly note that the men returning to this country, like the veterans of Vietnam, were not acknowledged and received a similar reception, that is, one of more disagreement with war and acceptance. From your perception of your research, in such terrible events where there has been death caused by friendly fire, is there anything a government or our government could have done in treating those men that might have eased some of their suffering?
They could have done a lot, but remember, this is the middle of Vietnam. Besides those 34 people who died, 187 other U.S. servicemen died in Vietnam, and they were dying in those numbers every week. I mean, it's tragic to say, and it's terrible to say, because in a country where we treasure every human life, we have become callous during Vietnam with 50,000 lives lost. And yes, they could have done a lot more. I wish they had done a lot more. Maybe the gentleman who was here would not be so bitter if they had, but they didn't, and that's a sad story. The Pedro occurred 5 months later. A similar type ship, slightly smaller, off the coast of North Korea. The North Koreans seized it, held the crew for almost a year, and finally released them. And as a result, as I mentioned in the book, the U.S. learned that it wasn't a very, very good idea to try and gather signal intelligence through these vessels. But you must know that in those days, we didn't have satellites. The most advanced satellite we had was Corona, which was a picture taker with no electronics or equipment. Now we have satellites that are so fantastic that we don't need those ships. Although, we still run the ET-3E, which is the one that went down in China a while ago, but we collect some intelligence. But we get more than what we need from the satellite. So, thank you very much.